Man, my recording just kills me every time I hear it from the Dirty Three's 2000 album, Whatever You Love, You Are. That was I Offered It Up to the Stars and Night Sky. It's one of my favorite recordings of all time. Thanks for tuning in, folks. This has been an Experiment with Time on WRCT Pittsburgh.
Had a dream that we all found love. Ain't nobody believe us. Ain't nobody believe. Give me hope so I won't give up. We got targets on our back, but we're not afraid to bleed. Don't need no rest, no. Long as you're by my side, we'll never lose that light, no. I swear these twisted roads someday they'll lead us home. Stay with me now. Stay with me now. Just like the fire and the smoke, yeah, we can keep each other close. Stay with me now. Stay with me now. Stay with me now.
You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, and welcome to another edition of Ebony Spectrum. I'm Kevin Amos. Rick and I have some more items for you this week. We're going to go listen to part two of A Slave Ship Called Jesus, a little stuff about P. Diddy, and much, much more. So stay with us.
Hello and welcome to Channels Book Club. My name is Olakunle Kasumu, and it's great to be on this show today. As always, a show where we discuss all things books. You will have noticed that we've been following the story of Angel Osariemen. Angel is a young lady who is trying to break the Guinness Book of World Record for marathon reading. Her objective at the beginning was to do at least 200 hours of reading, and she's gone over 130 hours now and still going strong. We're keeping an eye on that because this is not about Angel's ambition, we've observed. She wants to use this as a platform, as a leverage for promoting reading culture, particularly amongst young people in Edo State and Nigeria as a whole. What a vision. Fantastic. Considering everything Edo State has gone through over many years, unfortunately, young people, young ladies particularly being taken overseas for reasons nobody's proud of. Now, people like Angel are coming out and doing things like this to promote the reading culture. And everybody is rallying around her, which is very good. The governor of Edo State, the first lady of Edo State, captains of industry, led by the likes of Engineer Greg Ogbeifon of the maritime industry, and many, many people like that rallying around this young lady because I believe they see it as something very symbolic, something that could trigger something special in Edo State and Nigeria as a whole. So, well done, lady. Keep going, keep going, keep going. Well, I've got a book here with a fascinating title. Many years ago, a man called John Hawkins was a slave trader, an English slave trader. He came here, took people away, turned them into slaves in the Americas. Remember, we had over 400 years of the transatlantic slave trade. A lot of people don't know that over 4 million people were taken from this place that we now call Nigeria. That's apart from other places in Africa. I mean, this place that we now call Nigeria, over 4 million of our people were taken away to become slaves in the Americas. Did you know that? That's a bomb. That's big news. That's something we should study, we should research, find out what are the implications of that, and so on. Anyway, Hawkins went with slaves. And the Queen of England, Queen Elizabeth I, was happy about that venture. And she saw that it held a lot of potential profits for her and for England. So she dived into the business of slave trade. She gave John Hawkins a ship. She leased a ship to him for a second expedition. Now, that second expedition was very successful and made Queen Elizabeth I a lot of money and effectively made slave trade official in England. And England became the greatest slave trader in the whole of Western Europe and the world. Now, that ship she leased to John Hawkins was named, guess what? Jesus of Lübeck. And from there, Dele Ogun, our guest for today, came up with the title of his fascinating book, titled A Slave Ship Called Jesus. Well, that's the story behind the title. I thought I should tell you that story before I shared the title with you, in case you're wondering what kind of title is this. Well, that's the background. And this story, this book, exposes the history of the transatlantic slave trade. It's mind-blowing. I just kept reading and reading. I finished reading. I'm starting all over again. It's mind-blowing. Well, let's get to meet with Dele Ogun and then dive into this book of his, A Slave Ship Called Jesus. Enjoy this.
Dele Ogun is a historian, publisher, lawyer, speaker, and author. Ogun, who is the convener of the Fatherland Group, is an alumnus of London Metropolitan University, the Chartered Institute of Taxation of England and Wales, and the London School of Economics and Political Science. He is the author of several books, including A Fatherless People, Oyibo Came to Africa, Ostrich Nation, and The Law, the Lawyers, and the Lawless, 50 Years of Britain, amongst others. Ogun joins Channel's Book Club to discuss his latest book, A Slave Ship Called Jesus.
Dele Ogun, nice to have you on Channel's Book Club.
Thanks. Nice to be back.
Great to have you back. Fatherless.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Blockbuster book.
It's going good.
How has it been?
It's taken a life of its own. It has spawned a community of readers who themselves now crystallized into an organization called the Fatherland Group, which I regard as the de facto opposition party in this country, because there is no, it's one party rule that we have here. They cross from one party to the other. I call it Oambe politics. There's no ideology separating them. So there's a party over here and then there's a party over there. So we're filling the gap.
Let me spare you from the politicians listening to you now. Coming after you.
They love me, really. They know.
Okay. But I mean, you are essentially not a politician.
No.
A lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And I dare say primarily a historian. I mean, that's your passion.
That is what I've become. Mm. It's a metamorphosis.
Yeah. And you seem to be on a mission to help our people understand their story.
Absolutely.
The creation of Nigeria, what led to the creation of Nigeria, and how that history connects to our current day realities.
So like, very true.
Is that correct?
That is correct, because you see, we know we have a problem, and we've been trying to solve that problem for how long now? Our generation, your hairs, the gray hairs between ourselves.
I'm a young man.
Our fathers tried before them, and still the problem remains unsolved. You can't solve a problem until you understand it. Mm. We've skipped the learning exercise that precedes and must precede a solution. If you jump the understanding and say, we know it, we're going to move on to the solution, you will fall, you will stumble, you will collapse, which is what has been happening. So we've got to retrace our steps. And that means understanding the genesis of this Nigeria story. Not even from 1900, you've got to take it from the roots. And so that is the exercise that I've taken upon myself to say, help our people to understand it. Others will come with a solution. I think I've got part of the solution, but a real solution will be implemented by others. But the void, which is the understanding, especially in a country where they decided not to teach history, and we're almost like, in the context of history, we're like free-range chicken. You know, whatever you find is what you consume. So as a result, there's a lot of propaganda, there's a lot of gossip, there's a lot of beer parlorgists, rather than structured learning. And if we can all get onto the same page in terms of the understanding, then the solution becomes so much easier.
Well, I mean, there's a lot to talk about that. But since our focus is primarily on this, your new book, with a very interesting title, A Slave Ship Called Jesus. You know, when I first saw this book and I considered us featuring it, I said, I hope I won't get in trouble with viewers. I mean, considering, of course, for obvious reasons.
It is hard hitting.
Yeah, A Slave Ship Called Jesus. Why this title and what motivated this book? I would like you to introduce it to viewers, and then we dig in.
Yeah, I mean, as far as the title is concerned, I was just minding my own business. I was just, as any educated African should, seeking to teach myself about what happened in that trade. What was it all about? How did it start?
And by trade, you mean?
The slave trade.
Transatlantic
slave trade. How did it start? Mm. What was going on? And it's in the course of research that you come across certain factual details and finding that one of the ships was called Amazing Grace. Another one was called a slave ship. It was called, the Jesus of Lübeck. Now that hit me hard, given that I was raised in a Christian setting. I was struck by the fact that this evil trade, this where you ship people out of their continent, you wrench them out of their environment, you shove them into the boat, chain them down, you sail them across the oceans onto these plantations where they're often worked to death systematically. And these ships can be called the Jesus of Lübeck.
Religious names.
Religious names. Mm-hmm. And what's especially when you consider that this was a time when Christianity was very strong in Europe, such that attendance in church was compulsory. It's not like now they don't go to church. It's our people who are all running to the church. They don't go. But then their approach to church was as our approach is now. And just imagine us in this era, assuming the trade never happened, and assuming we were the ones going to initiate the trade. And the ship, we say, is going to be called the Jesus of Lübeck, the grace of God. How does that happen?
So ships used to take human cargoes from here to the Americas and so on were labeled
Grace of God, and then of course Jesus of Lübeck.
Yeah,
that's where your title.
That's where my they gave me the title. They gave me the title.
Interesting. Let's dig into this. I mean, we don't have so much time, but we'll try. Do you think that not enough is known about a slave trade history? And what's the danger of this ignorance?
We certainly do not know enough about this very vital period in our existence. This was three centuries. This was the 1600s to the late 1800s.
About 400 years.
That is a huge chunk of one's civilized existence not to know anything about. And in contrast, China, who we try to say we want to aspire to be, they are so versed in their history. The Chinese. Every aspect of their history. They have a concept called the 100 years of national humiliation. So they soak themselves in the understanding and knowledge of what happened, because that's a key part to how you got to where you are. But if we say it all happened a long time ago, it means that the events that happened then, we're not able to recognize them in our present. So for example, much of our setting now, the kind of governance that we have, is not wholly dissimilar to plantation life, where you had overseers over the enslaved unfortunates laboring in the fields in all sorts of inhumane conditions. And then the overseers sat above them, punishing them accordingly, and they were rewarded because the overseers were just like the managers on the ground. The owners will be back home in England, back home in America, back home in Europe. So you see that relationship, you could almost transpose it to what we have now in terms of what we call governance. And that's because we haven't studied the past. We can't recognize that in reality, what we call democracy today, it's almost like plantation. It's just slight redecoration, but substantively much the same.
Interesting. A slave ship called Jesus is basically the story of the transatlantic slave trade.
Yes.
In many ways.
Yes.
I would like you to, is that correct? Would you like to elaborate a bit on what this book is about?
It is essentially a study of the trade, but with particular reference to faith, with particular reference to Christianity, the church in relation to that trade, especially when people understand that the trade was conducted under license from the head of the church, the Pope, as it then was. Until England now, initially, England was not party to that trade. They became the league champions.
So it was initially Spain.
It was initially Spain and Portugal.
And Portugal,
because Spain was the lead Catholic country. And you could only get into the trade under license from the Pope.
So he gave licenses for people to come to this part of the world, take people, and then go and sell.
Yes.
So basically, it was a business.
It was that
needed licensing.
It was a commercial enterprise. Mm-hmm. It was controlled. And the book explains how the British now got into the trade, which was the creation of the Church of England. When Henry VIII needed his divorce from the daughter of the King of Spain, because Spain was like America today, the enforcer, the global enforcer, there was no way the Pope was going to approve that divorce. So what did Henry do? He did what I call the original Brexit, the first Brexit. He declared, I'm leaving, and I'm leaving with my people. I'm leaving the Catholic fold. I'm setting up my own church. He made himself the head of the church and granted himself his divorce.
And remarried.
And remarried. And that now freed England to enter the trade, and it was actually his daughter. Yeah,
because because English businessmen, let's call them that, suddenly found out that they did not need the approval or the license of the Pope to get into the business of slave trade, right?
Correct.
Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Because so it sort of like freed, opened the markets.
It opened the markets. That move of taking themselves out meant, just like the recent Brexit, whilst they were within Europe, they were bound by the rules of European trade, etc. By the Brexit that we all followed the debates around, etc., they now freed themselves to make whatever trade deals they want. Similarly, in that original religious Brexit, where they pulled themselves out of the Catholic fold, set up their own church, they were now free to go in and do what they like. And the profits were so huge that they couldn't simply stand aside. And so that's when the ship that was owned by the royal family, it was
Queen Elizabeth I.
Queen Elizabeth I. She had inherited the ship from her father, King Henry VIII, and she now chartered that ship to the slave trade.
To John Hawkins.
To John Hawkins.
And his family. I mean, viewers who probably have not read this, the Jesus of Lübeck ship, which she named this book after, was owned by Queen Elizabeth I.
Correct.
Right? Queen Elizabeth I gave it to John Hawkins, the slave trader, for business.
Yes.
And then the profits from it was shared.
Yes.
So the Queen made a lot of money.
It was her contribution to the business, like any business.
Investment.
Yes, an investment. That's my contribution to the capital with which we're going to trade.
So this... we don't have enough time to discuss this because it's my head is just spinning. You know, I mean, when I was reading your book, I've read it once. Now I'm going to read it two more times. Mm-hmm. I promise myself that because there's no way you can grasp all this from one reading. It was, I mean, at the risk of repeating what we've said, it was a structured, organized business,
absolutely
sanctioned by the government of England,
absolutely correct.
Which and the government of England, which was also at that point in time, more or less synergized with the Church of England,
yes,
basically,
indeed, indeed.
So,
indeed, and this is very important for our people to understand because you know we often get caught up in a conversation. People say we were selling our own people.
Now, yeah, that's another thing.
It is so important to understand that this was a structured enterprise. It wasn't, I want people to understand, it wasn't as if we here had for sale signs over our people. They came initially, the first boatload that Hawkins got, he kidnapped them off the
about
coast.
300
a whole slaves. Boatload, 300 slaves.
Yeah.
300 people.
People.
We were now enslaved. And he now sailed off with them and sold them in Haiti.
Yeah.
And it was the profits from that. They were so huge. They now convinced them that this was the way to go. So more and more ships were now diverted into that trade. And now it became more sophisticated because the coastal peoples now became wary. Whenever the ships were coming in, they ran further inland. But some of the ones that they had taken away, as always, there will be some who will be good workers. Some of those will be co-opted. They now have the language. They can go in and speak to the peoples. And they were sent in to reassure the coastal peoples that we're not after you. We're not going to touch you. Work with us. Here are the guns.
Gin, rum.
Rum, gin, guns.
So you argue that, our people, if our people had not been involved in selling their own brothers, nothing would have happened. So you argue that that's not accurate.
Yes.
You argue that they were manipulated, right?
Mm-hmm.
They were coerced to get into the business.
Absolutely.
That's your argument.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a nonsense narrative that was spun that we ran with because we had not done our own research. Well, what became interesting was that when abolition came, and the book explains the real reasons for abolition, that it wasn't a change of hearts. It was a change of thinking. And it was a change of thinking forced upon the slavers by the Africans who had revolted, in particular in Haiti. It was the Haitian Revolution that now made it clear that they can't sustain the trade any longer. And that's when they started thinking of abolition. And in the course of the abolition debates, because they didn't, those who were profiting from the system, because any political system has winners and losers, those who were profiting from the system weren't going to roll over and say, you take my daily bread away. They were resisting, they were holding on. And so the arguments in parliament were actually very revealing. One side arguing that it's evil, it's got to go, etc. The other one says, no, we need it, it must continue, etc. And in the course of those exchanges, evidence spills out as to how the trade was really being instigated. And I remember one of the prime ministers who said that it is we who are instigating the trade. It is we who have the demand. It is we who supply the weapons for them to go and fight other groups and capture them and in order to supply our needs.
Mm. There are so many angles to your... Look, I really enjoyed reading your book.
I'm glad.
I mean, I love history, you know. There are so many angles.
Mm.
Catholicism, Protestantism, there's that angle of a lot of people, a lot of us don't realize that these two religious concepts, faiths, I don't know, faith, you can't say faiths, anyway. That they were interwoven with the politics.
Oh, yes.
Of those days.
Yes.
There was no difference between states and religion at a point in time. That happened later on.
Yes.
Particularly in England.
Mm-hmm.
But they were interwoven. And so I enjoyed reading, learning about that in your book. I enjoyed the history of England, which I think every Nigerian should know. Because if we don't understand the history of England, we may not fully understand the story very well. I enjoy that part of your book. I enjoy the connection, just seeing that, oh, all the blacks in Haiti and Jamaica and all that. The other day I was in a vehicle and I saw a black, there was a black taxi driver driving. And I said, you know, you and I might be family. I don't know. And this was in the US.
Yes.
I said, you and I might be family. Mm. And he said, how? And I told him a bit of the history of slave trade. And he said, oh, wow. You know,
it was one of the points that I was keen to get across, that there's a disconnect between the Africans that were taken away and those of us who remained. And one of the things I wanted to do was, rather than call them Jamaicans and call them Haitians, you see that I adopted the style of calling them the Africans in Haiti, the Africans in Jamaica, the Africans in America, the Africans in Barbados.
Mm.
Because that is the reality.
That's a reality.
That is the reality. And I wanted to sort of nip in the bud that attitude that was developing amongst those of us who were fortunate to remain, whereby we looked down upon those people.
Mm.
We despised them as if to say that these were lesser peoples, whereas it would any of us, and indeed many of our lines will be, you find, if you trace it, you'll find kith and kin amongst those who were taken away.
Mm.
So I needed to create the bridge. Mm-hmm. But in the process, also teach our people the vital history, which includes the history of Britain, as you said.
So much to learn about our slave trade history. So much to learn. I suspect that when we learn those things, our eyes will just pop open, and so many things to learn about our slave trade history. Well, this is where we have to end the show today. As always, we'll be delighted to get your feedback through any of our social media platforms displayed on your screen. My name is Olakunle Kasumu. Remember, one great book can change your life. Bye-bye.
You are listening to Ebony Spectrum on WRCT Pittsburgh.
What people do with them and how we talk about it.
That nigga's tripping.
All right, so you guys might be familiar with user at T Motimo, because I pinned one of his comments underneath the Aaliyah video and he was arguing with everybody underneath it. But I'm going to pick out one of his comments specifically. All right. Ooh, I just get so irritated when I see it. So at Timo says, this the type videos that are driving wedges between black men and women, shaking my head. I really like her video, by the way. I could stop there. But promoting that black men hate black women, us ridiculous. He meant is ridiculous. Speaking about the trials black women have gone through in the music industry at the hands of black men, as if black men created this atmosphere. As if black men created this atmosphere because we hate y'all, but don't tell how black men have been treated by the music industry. I'm gonna keep going. Saying Willie Lynch wasn't real, because he wasn't. That cannot be proven, but it can. But what is true, period, is whether his name... I'm gonna stop being petty. All right, but what is true is whether his name was Willie or Walter, he was very much a real person that they very much did have sit downs all over the country and speak to and bounce ideas back and forth. No, they did not. It's fabricated. On how to control slaves, enslaved people. Last point. Nobody hated black women because they listened to R. Kelly or because merch is being sold at high prices. Hitler and every other famous person the world hated is still spoken about. Are they selling Hitler t-shirts? All right, bro, I can go down this like a list of bullet points. Let's start right from the top. All right, number one, let's see, at Tomo Timo. Number one, this the type videos that are driving wedges between black men and black women, shaking my head. There is already a wedge between black men and black women because of the way historically it has been culturally accepted for black men to treat black women. That divide already exists. It is already there. Bringing it up, shining light on it, doesn't create the wedge. It shines a light on the area that is broken so people can see it so it can be fixed. Y'all just like to say so much that it's discouraging and it's disappointing to hear black women speak out about these things, so you'd rather us be silent? When you insinuate that a problem should not be highlighted, you're asking people to be silent about their suffering, and that does nothing but create a faulty or weaker foundation. Don't get me wrong, everything is white people's fault. Absolutely. But people want to act like black women are the blame for the disconnect between black men and black women, when those same black men would want white people to be held accountable for their problems, number one. There are so many layered parts to this conversation that would show how being oppressed leads to divides between, or violence, domestic abuse, sexual abuse, verbal abuse, emotional abuse, lack of emotional availability. All of those things can be attributed back to some type of handed down trauma or oppression. Yes, we can trace it back how it got to white folks, but all of that has been, all the things that they have done to create this divide between us has been intentional. And it's been the cause of us not being able to stand together. You want black women to be silent about what they got going on right now so we can stand together to fix the issues of black people as a whole, which more often than not refers to the issues of black men. But you're not understanding and how the things that are being done to one another in our communities are contributing to the further divide or contributing to the lack of us being able to unify on a stronger basis. Number two. I really like her video, by the way.
Stop it. Get some help.
You liking my content does not make what you say after that statement any less disrespectful or problematic. You liking my content isn't gonna make me say, hey, oh, that's so sweet. I'm gonna dial back on how I respond to you. That is a type of microaggression. You showing some type of regard for someone's craft, talent, or contribution as if your valuation of their talent or contribution matters, as if it holds weight. Moving along. Damn it, my phone just died. Not you wasn't even dying. You just wanted to show me a black screen with an apple so I couldn't talk my shit. It's the government. Number three. When we talk about hating black women, there are some of you that just straight up hate us. You don't want to date us. You want to be with everybody else because you think we too loud, obnoxious, whatever, whatever. But then there are those of you who practice this sort of unthinking, insidious type of hate to where you treat black women a certain way because it has become culturally acceptable and you are unconscious of its consequences. And therefore you think you've done nothing wrong. But when we say you hate us, we talk about kind of like that kid who has a magnifying glass putting it over an ant and is just watching it die. Like, that's interesting. Ridgeway, get out of there! It's one of those things where, hey, I'm oppressed. I'm going to take my oppression out on this other person. And it's okay because I'm oppressed and this person is lower than me on the food chain, so they should just expect to be treated this way. Or I don't necessarily have to be accountable for the things that I do to this person, because who's going to check me for hurting this person that everybody else already hates? And I can just get away with acting like I don't hate them because we're the same skin color and we have some of the same issues. This comment comes from Digit Queen. She goes, I don't agree with abortion, but I do feel that women should have the right to choose. Also, many women just use abortion as a form of birth control. Whoa. How do we all have all of these issues and still have unprotected sex and or random sex, period? What about that? And you are late on your period and you had unprotected sex and you're poor as fuck, and now you talk about blaming the government because said woman wants an abortion. At the end of the day, I say be effing responsible for your body and what you do with it. How about that? I knew people were going to say this. I said, let's also note the arguments that women should be more responsible if they don't want to have babies. Keep in mind that birth control is not 100%. And at the end of the day, it's rape culture. Saying that we should be more responsible with how we have sex with people, whatever, what have you. Woo, Digit Queen. Because the thing about it is number one, birth control is not 100%. You can use condoms all day. It can break. You cannot even know it break. When you're pulling it out, something can spill, whatever. Literally happens to people all the time.
No, God, please, no.
Number two, birth control pills. If you mess up, like, you could be done for. None of the options, even the implanted versions, are 100%. So there is no way of completely protecting yourself from getting pregnant. Now, I do agree, especially for women who enjoy sex and enjoy sex with multiple partners, to wrap it up, because STDs. I mean, I also live in Atlanta, STDs. But responsibility for safe sex and responsibility for not getting pregnant should not be on women, because let's be clear, a woman cannot get pregnant unless there is a sperm that fertilizes her egg. It cannot happen. Jeffrey Spriggs, your turn. He said the same thing, but he put some Hotep in there. He put a splice of Hotepery in there. Jeffrey Spriggs says, this is 2021. Is Jeffrey white? Oh, Jeffrey is black. Jeffrey is a black man. This is 2021. Black women need to stop aborting and killing their babies. The most dangerous places for a black child is in their mother's womb. Yikes. He hates us too. Woo! This argument is getting old. Women have 31 forms of birth control. I don't know if you're exaggerating, but I wouldn't be surprised if we did. Be more responsible, wrap it up, take the pill, IUD, morning after pill, mother, stop killing the life inside your womb. Jerry, if you don't get the hell on, talking about the most dangerous place for a black child is in their mother's room. I don't know the streets. I don't know, in the custody of police officers. I don't know, at school. Other dangerous places for black children. I don't know, walking home from school so they don't get kidnapped, especially young black girls. This is the type of shit that makes me very careful about who I associate myself with in terms of the cause for liberation of the black race. Because there are a lot of arguments, there are a lot of ideologies, rather, that tie up black people's liberation and black men's dominance and black men's ascension to power. And a lot of that has to do with stationing black women in a specific gender role so that she can be in service to black men and using her uterus to repopulate the world with black children. There are a lot of people who make comments about how these new abortion laws are probably about white people being able to prevent white women from getting abortions so they can have more white people, because they're becoming less and less. But there's kind of always been this idea that we need to repopulate the earth with black people, and the lack of population of black people is one of the issues of us not being a strong race. And all of that is foolishness, taken from the book of Dr. Umar Johnson. It's sexist, it's violent. Where are the conversations? Where are the comments about pullout game? Where are the comments about ensuring that you wrap it up, gentlemen? Why are we telling women to use condoms and not men to use condoms? Why are we not talking to men about that when it comes to abortion? Like, if you want to reduce abortions, let's talk to young men about that. Because I think also the issue is not about women getting pregnant. It's about making sure women have babies once they get pregnant. One more.
Another one.
This one isn't problematic, but it did bring up something that challenged my thinking. And I think it's something other people should be cognizant of as well. Jay Wall says, Lanezi, love you.
Love you too.
And these facts, indeed, these facts you spit in. I do want us to move away from talking about this as an issue that only impacts women, because there are several bodies, trans men, for example, or genderqueer folks, who have been gravely impacted by this. Anyone with a uterus can get pregnant. It's the intersectional analysis for me. And we love to see it. We love to bring the people in the room who deserve to be in the room. Imagine, especially for trans men in this situation, becoming pregnant, who did not want to become pregnant, how mentally and psychologically debilitating that experience can be. And then to not have the option to get an abortion can be terrifying. So I just want that to be something that everyone takes home and keeps in mind, a learning experience for me and you. And that's it for this week's In the Comments. I'll see you next time.
This is the Black World Media Network, putting the global diaspora issues up front. Professor Ron Daniels is the president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. And this is From the Desk of the Professor.
It's a pity if Diddy did it. Shocking. Breaking news, live all over local and national television. Squads of heavily armed FBI agents storm the fabulous, luxurious, palatial estate of Sean Puffy Combs, most recently known as P. Diddy, searching for evidence that this renowned hip-hop legend and business mogul may have been involved in sex trafficking. Can you believe it? Diddy is already facing multiple allegations of sexual harassment and assault by several women. Sex trafficking. Why would Diddy play such a dangerous game? For money, Diddy is already damn near a billionaire. So why would he risk fame, fortune, and reputation in such a despicable enterprise? It's a low-down dirty shame if Diddy did it. But innocent until proven guilty. Hashtag, did Diddy do it?
That viewpoint was ripped from the desk of the professor, Ron Daniels. Listen daily for a view on a myriad of issues from the desk of the professor. This is the Black World Media Network.
Yesterday, federal agents executed search warrants at two properties in Los Angeles and Miami belonging to rap mogul Sean Diddy Combs. A source familiar with the matter told NBC News that Combs is the subject of a federal investigation following a wave of lawsuits that have been filed against him. Those lawsuits, including from his former girlfriend, Cassie Ventura, alleged physical and sexual abuse, which Combs has denied. The source also confirmed that three women and a man have been interviewed by federal officials in Manhattan in relation to allegations of sex trafficking, sexual assault, and the solicitation and distribution of illegal narcotics and firearms. Late today, Combs' lawyer issued the following statement. Quote, yesterday, there was a gross overuse of military-level force as search warrants were executed at Mr. Combs' residences. There was no excuse for the excessive show of force and hostility exhibited by authorities or the way his children and employees were treated. Mr. Combs was never detained, but spoke to and cooperated with authorities. Despite media speculation, neither Mr. Combs nor any of his family members have been arrested, nor has their ability to travel been restricted in any way. This unprecedented ambush, paired with an advanced coordinated media presence, leads to a premature rush to judgment of Mr. Combs and is nothing more than a witch hunt based on meritless accusations made in civil lawsuits. There's been no finding of criminal or civil liability with any of these allegations. Mr. Combs is innocent and will continue to fight every single day to clear his name. Unquote. Joining me now is Toray, host of Masters of the Game. The new season premieres Friday on The Griot. What is going on? Because we did also see Diddy's sons arrested. They were detained. They weren't arrested. They were just detained. Yeah. But what is going on?
Well, it seems that there are several people who are saying things about Combs to the government, and they are trying to figure out what's going on. I found it interesting that they had enough to get a search warrant, right, for multiple places, but not enough yet to arrest him. So we're in the investigation phase, and clearly they don't care if we let him know that we know what's going on.
Yeah.
But it seems part of his whole life, his whole journey has been this sort of scorched earth campaign where you see him continuing to succeed or do big things and leave people in his wake hurt. We go back to CCNY, which he a party that he overpromoted that people yes. ended up getting killed. You think about the many artists who either left, you know, in complaint or went to the church or, you know, died nice. After, you okay. know, I mean, there was a lot of disheartened artists who left him
yeah.
that he raised up.
Shine.
On and on. And now this large growing number of people who are alleging crazy stuff
yes.
about him.
Yeah.
And these are things that people in the industry have been hearing about.
It's giving
time.
R. Kelly, Torrey. It's giving it's disturbing.
You know, I was personally disturbed many years ago. OK, I know this man well enough to call him and say, hey, I need a favor.
Yeah.
And this might have been 10, 12 years ago that I called him and say, hey, I have a family member who I want you to hire them as an intern.
Yeah.
And I have never talked about this publicly. And he said, yes. And they were flying around, one of the interns, Atlanta, Miami, whatever, on the jet, in the house, whatever. And then the internship stopped abruptly, like 3 or 4 months into it.
Yeah.
And I spoke to my family member, like, well, what happened? And they wouldn't say.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why did it end? And he wouldn't yeah. say. And years later, they finally came out, and this is a male,
yeah.
and said that Puff had said, come home, stay the night with me, or the internship is over. And they said, absolutely not. He said, absolutely not. And the internship ended. But from there, I was like, this is how it goes. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So to hear that things went even further with potentially, allegedly, many other people,
yeah.
we feel like we've seen this coming.
Well, there was the situation with obviously Russell Simmons, who does not live in the United States any further. Mm-hmm. You've had these situations, obviously, with R. Kelly. This feels like it is going down that kind of a track because you have multiple accusers with nothing proved. He's not been adjudicated a, you know, whatever, but it's just talking.
Videos.
And he paid Cassie a lot of money.
A lot of money. And, you know, the people are coming with videos, though. I mean, like evidence, not just hearsay. So, I mean, this is a very, very frightening situation. There was a period in the record business when a lot of wildness was going on
yeah.
of this sort. And sure. here's another shoe dropping.
Yeah. And the thing is, I think, talk about where he stands, because what he's saying sounds very Trumpy.
Yeah.
He's talking about a witch hunt.
Yeah.
I had somebody text me earlier today. I think I texted you today and forwarded it to you that somebody is saying watch for him to try to weaponize sort of a Trump sort of narrative, or watch the Trump people try to weaponize what's happening in favor of Trump to say, look, there's this persecuted black man like me that who's like me, and try to weaponize it.
I mean,
it feels very Trumpish.
I hate to say that anyone is like Trump, but there is something in the rise, the long-term rise of Puff, in that he seemed to create his own reality, to
yeah.
demand that everyone around him follow what he wanted.
Yeah.
And people did. He had a ton of money behind him to start Bad Boy at a very young age.
Yeah.
And would just treat me. I mean, he's called me up and screamed at me on more than one occasion, and lots
yeah.
of people would say that. So the ego was gigantic. The
yeah.
ability to create the reality that he wanted
yeah.
seemed to be there.
But also to create a reality that was dangerous. I mean, I think for a lot of hip-hop fans, the failure to protect Notorious B.I.G., the sort of egging on of an East Coast, West Coast rivalry between friends that were people who knew and respected each other and didn't have to be beefing, and to sort of let that violence come. You know, I think for a lot of us, and that, and also oversampling and making hip hop into a sample machine. Don't get me started.
Now you're doing that.
Now I'm doing that. But I'm only doing that because you're my friend and you'll defend me. No, don't get me started, Aunt Saray. How does this go? Is he in the United States? Do we know where he is?
I don't know. I can't even call it. I don't know.
Well, you have to come back when you get more information. Torrey, thank you.
Music mogul and rapper Sean Diddy Combs has faced 4 different lawsuits in recent weeks alleging sexual assault and abuse, all of which he has denied. The first of those came from singer Cassie Ventura, known as Cassie, who accused Combs of sexual abuse and sex trafficking during the decade they were together. NBC's entertainment correspondent Chloe Malas spoke exclusively to a longtime friend of Cassie's who said she witnessed some troubling incidents. Chloe?
Good evening, Ellison. Singer-songwriter activist Tiffany Redd had been working with Cassie on an album when she first met Diddy and says that she witnessed him verbally abusing her friend. Following Cassie's settlement with Diddy, Redd penned an open letter in Rolling Stone about her experience. She spoke to me about the events that she says traumatized her.
I don't think people understand what it's like to be traumatized by somebody famous and rich, because you can't get away from them.
Tiffany Redd has written for the likes of Zendaya, Jason Derulo, and Jennifer Hudson. In 2015, she became friends with Cassie while writing songs for her album. At that point, Cassie and Diddy had been together for nearly 8 years. In a lawsuit Cassie filed last month, she detailed the abuse she says Diddy committed, including physical assault. Redd says although she did not know about the alleged physical assault while working with Cassie, she did witness verbal abuse on more than one occasion. One of which took place during Cassie's 29th birthday in 2015. Redd says Diddy showed up at karaoke where Cassie and a group of friends were celebrating.
So he had her backed into the corner and he was like cussing her out with his hand in her face.
Later that night, Redd, who was staying at Cassie's home, says she awoke to screaming.
Oh, he's standing in the like living room area and she's there. And he was like, emotional singing, bitch, there you are. And I just was like, oh, he's talking to me. And I remember, like, I don't know if you know what his voice sounds like, but, like, I felt like I was in the presence of his monster inside. And I remember, like, looking in his eyes, and I said to him, what did y'all do? Because I could see that she was, like, really sedated. That was the first time I'd ever seen her, like, high before. And then he says, tell your girl she wants some birthday. And we were like, well, I mean, he's saying this to me, and I'm like, well, she doesn't have to have sex with you if she doesn't want to. He was upset, like, you know, I guess that she didn't want to do with him whatever he wanted. I don't know. I don't feel like I could advocate for myself in that moment. Like, I realized, like, oh, this guy is dangerous.
Redd says it was only a few months ago that Cassie told her what was really going on that night in 2015, that it all stemmed from the music executive wanting her to take part in what he called a freak-off against her will.
What did Cassie tell you about these freak-offs?
You know, that he would hire these, like, sex workers and, like, they would have, you know, sex with her or whatever, and he would watch and tell them what to do.
In her lawsuit, Cassie alleges she was forced to participate in freak-offs throughout her relationship with Diddy. Redd learning recently one horrific detail from Cassie.
She told me the only time he was willing to do anything or work on her music, go through any plans, any of that, was when she had a freak-off. So all of our music, all my work, to find out that, like, I spent all these years writing these songs for him to rape my friend to, like, is just disgusting.
In the lawsuit, Cassie detailed the physical abuse she says Diddy committed, including an instance where she was put in a hotel room for days to heal. Redd says Cassie recently told her about Diddy giving her a black eye before the premiere of her 2016 film, The Perfect Match.
I remember one time her telling me that, I think it might have been The Perfect Match, that movie that she was in, and she told me that she had a black eye under her makeup.
Do you believe Diddy is a dangerous person?
Yes, I do.
Why?
I mean, look at his rap sheet.
An attorney for Cassie declined to comment. Diddy's attorney did not respond. In 2015, Diddy was arrested on 3 counts of assault with a deadly weapon and other charges for allegedly beating up his son's football coach. Prosecutors declined to file felony charges related to that arrest. 24 hours after Cassie filed her lawsuit, she and Diddy announced that they had reached an undisclosed settlement. Combs released a statement saying, "We have decided to resolve this matter amicably. I wish Cassie and her family all the best." His lawyer adding that the settlement was, quote, "in no way an admission of wrongdoing."
I mean, I just feel like it's PR. He's settled because he doesn't want to go to court.
Diddy's music career spans 3 decades, including 3 Grammy Awards and the creation of Bad Boy Records, representing artists from Mary J. Blige to the late Notorious B.I.G. In September, he was awarded MTV's Global Icon Award. But since the allegations surfaced, Hulu scrapped a reality series about his family, and the Recording Academy said they are considering to rescind his invite to this year's Grammys.
You know, I think a lot of people, especially in the black community, are, you know, I've seen the narrative of, like, you know, they just trying to take a black man down. And it's just like, that's not what this is about. That's not what this is about. This is about accountability and a reckoning. Like, that's just the bottom line.
As for what justice looks like,
I think justice looks like Diddy being behind bars. And I also think that justice looks like everybody getting retribution for all of the things, the amount of therapy. Like I just said, all of the moments, the time, like these are our careers.
And Chloe is back with us now. You hear her saying justice looks like Diddy behind bars. Is there a possibility that could still happen? Where does the criminal case stand?
So Cassie filed her federal civil suit here in New York, and the NYPD has come out and said that there is no investigation into Diddy right now. Now, that doesn't mean that the district attorney of Manhattan isn't looking into something or perhaps investigations going on behind the scenes. But publicly, on the record, no such investigation has been confirmed. And also, there have been other lawsuits of some women coming forward with other similar accusations and allegations. And who knows if others might come forward as well. Remember, the Adult Survivors Act is set to expire at the end of this month in the state of California. And we know that Diddy, that is where he has primarily resided. So you never know if others might come forward between now and the new year.
And you spent so much time talking with Tiffany, and you can tell, even watching that back, not being in the room with her, that she has been so deeply impacted by what she says she witnessed. She has been able to sort of take this and turn it in a way, right? Can you explain that?
So she calls herself an activist, right? She's not just a singer-songwriter who's worked with so many stars, like I mentioned, Zendaya, Jason Derulo, Cassie. You know, she is somebody that has started an organization called the 100 Percenters, and that's, she says, comes from the fact that she always gives 100%. And this is about advocating for equal pay and fair rights for those who are both artists and writers and music producers, and helping also get them out of archaic music contracts. So she has turned her tragedy and her trauma into something positive. But she said that speaking out to NBC News, speaking out to us, has helped her heal. And she also wants to stand up for her friend Cassie and validate what's in that lawsuit.
Amazing.
The transatlantic slave trade, male-female relationships from Lene and P. Diddy. Oh my God.
All right, guys, welcome to the show and happy Wednesday. We got a lot to talk about. There's a lot going on in the world. A lot of people are saying 2024 is the year of exposure, and they may damn well be right because a lot of people are getting exposed this year. We're going to be talking about P. Diddy, Sean Combs, whatever it is you want to call him, the fact that his house was recently raided, and the investigation is probably going to go through as far as all the sex trafficking allegations that have been placed against him. Plus, we got a ton of girls just being punched in the face in New York City. I don't know what's going on there. Also, a bridge in Baltimore collapsed after a ship collided with it. Now people are getting all conspiratorial about that. But one thing they're getting wrong is the accusation that DEI had something to do with it. But we're going to get into all that and more. Before we do, we got Taylor in Nashville.
Hey, happy Wednesday. Did he do it? That is the question of the day, isn't it?
Yeah, I feel like he done it. Did he did it? Okay, let's just go ahead and put that out there. At least that's what I believe, okay? Don't send any shooters for me. I believe he did it. Now,
allegedly.
Yeah, allegedly. No, we're going to get into all this P. Diddy stuff because you guys have probably been seeing his name all over the news. As I said, his house was raided recently by, I believe, the FBI and the DOJ, who and they were looking for evidence, so they say, in regard to this large sex trafficking ring that he allegedly was running. They're calling him the Jeffrey Epstein of hip-hop. But for those of you who are unfamiliar, I'm going to let somebody else break it down and give you all the major details. We can watch this together and sort of get our feet on the ground when it comes to this story.
Federal agents raided the L.A. and Miami homes of billionaire hip-hop mogul Sean Diddy Combs. Homeland Security conducted the armed raid in an alleged sex trafficking operation. TMZ later capturing Diddy pacing around a private Miami airstrip. Diddy wasn't arrested, but his phones were seized. And there's speculation tonight that he's fled the country. We can't confirm it. Just breaking tonight, though, Diddy's attorney is putting out a statement saying, quote, there is no excuse for the excessive show of force and hostility exhibited by authorities. This unprecedented ambush, paired with advanced coordinated media presence, leads to a premature rush to judgment of Mr. Combs and is nothing more than a witch hunt. We believe the raid was triggered by a litany of lawsuits, including from his own ex, alleging abuse, rape, and sex trafficking. Diddy settled that one, but then, 2 months ago, his former producer, Rodney Lil Rod Jones, filed an explosive lawsuit containing disturbingly graphic and disgusting details that not only implicate Diddy, but aim straight at the heart of the music industry. An elaborate racketeering, blackmail, and sex trafficking scheme that his lawyers compare to Jeffrey Epstein's.
Yeah, I was going to say, does that at all sound familiar to you guys? Sort of racketeering blackmail scheme that involves the sex trafficking of minors. Are we at all shocked to hear that this news is happening within, you know, yet another elite industry here in our country? No, I'm starting to think you're not going to find an industry in this country where stuff like this isn't happening. Of course, we have the whole Jeffrey Epstein back and forth, he who did not kill himself, that we've all been talking about for a very long time now. This, of course, comes on the heels of the conversations we've been having surrounding Nickelodeon and the Quiet on Set documentary that recently came out that involved, yes, the sexual assault of minors, not just one, many. So, am I at all surprised to hear that this is also happening within the hip-hop industry and that there may be a blackmail scheme involved with this? No, I am not. And interestingly enough, this is forcing me to go back in my memory to hear about, to think about other rappers who have spoken out about this. And you all know when Kanye was on his whole, what we were calling a crazy rant, when he was talking about all these different rappers and just coming out with these just bombastic statements, I'm going back and listening to a lot of this stuff and I'm like, you know, he's sounding correct, because he was in an interview talking about P. Diddy and saying P. Diddy was a fed and that he is working alongside the feds in some sort of major scheme. He did not state what that scheme was, but now that I'm looking back at it, blackmail, racketeering, you know, shuffling around of new elite people within the industry, blackmailing political figures and other elites is starting to make a little bit of sense. It's starting to make a little bit too much.
See you next week, folks. Oh, my goodness.
Had a dream that we all found love. Ain't nobody believe us. Ain't nobody believe. Give me hope so I won't give up. We got targets on our back, but we're not afraid to bleed. Don't need no rest, no. Long as you're by my side, we'll never lose that light, no. I swear these twisted roads, someday they'll lead us home. Stay with me now, stay with me now. Just like a fire and a smoke, yeah, we can keep each other close. Stay with me now, stay with me now. Stay with me now.
Stay with me now. I swear these twisted roads someday they'll lead us. Like the fire and the smoke, yeah, we can keep each other close. Stay with me now, stay with me now. Had a dream that we all found love. Ain't nobody believe us, ain't nobody believe. Give me hope so I won't give up. Targets on our back, but we're not afraid.